There are many systems of picking a winner. Some fans get their dope straight from the feed bag. Others right from the horse's mouth.
Listen, Doc. There's a bay filly in the toid that's looking pretty good to me.
There were these two racing dudes named Aaron and Jared who had advice on racing and they wanted to share it. Started a website where players go to see all their picks. The goal was make the fans some money and to cut down the risk. They put the plan into motion and at first it seemed silly. Make a website where the expert picks are freer than Willie. From a racetrack better into just a beginner. There's one place that you want to go to find you a winner. As a matter of fact, I want to hit the exacta. There's only one site that you'll keep coming back to. So next time that the horses all line up at the post, make sure you use the website that'll win you the most. Whether Churchill, Oaklawn, Gulfstream Park, Saratoga, and all tracks in between, there's only one site to go to. When it comes to your racing needs and all of your bets, plus it's got a catchy name that no one ever forgets. RacingDudes.com for all of your needs. RacingDudes.com for all of your leads. RacingDudes.com for all of your bets. RacingDudes.com, as good as it gets. RacingDudes.com for all of your needs. RacingDudes.com for all of your leads. RacingDudes.com for all of your bets. RacingDudes.com, as good as it gets.
Welcome to Blinkers Off. This is podcast one of two as it relates to the Preakness Stakes. I'm Jared Welch. He's Aaron Altman. What's up?
This will be my favorite of the two podcasts. Do you know why?
Why?
Because we don't have to do anything on this podcast.
John White.
John White's on this one. He talks for the majority of the time, which is always good for us and the listeners because...
you actually get good content.
An actual person that knows what he's talking about is going to be on the podcast today. So that's always great. And yeah, we don't, you know, we're like everybody else. We just let him talk and we listen and we learn.
Yeah, we recorded the interview yesterday, last night, so it, you know, we are going to play that coming up. But yeah, it's fascinating. You know, we know the guy very well and we talk to him all the time off the air, but when we get on the show, you know, it's like he gets his game face on and you hear all kinds of stories. This is, you know, I posted this on Twitter earlier today and you have to listen to this, and not saying it for, you know, to help us or whatever. You have to listen to this before you bet on the Preakness.
Yeah.
Or the Triple Crown for that matter, moving forward. It's that good.
No, it is. It's really good as always. And you're right. It's just, sometimes I love, not sometimes, all times, I love to listen to the podcast. But when he's been on last time and this time, I love to go back and listen to the whole interview because I miss things sometimes. I mean, he's got so much knowledge that you really have to listen closely at times. And when you're interviewing a person, you're listening, but at the same time, you're trying to think of the next question.
Yeah.
Where now I can go back and just listen and actually, you know, take it all in. It was a great interview, but, you know, that's what's expected, right?
Yep. So today's show, what we're going to do, John White. He's a Santa Anita odds maker, longtime horse racing journeyman. I mean, he does everything in the sport. So he's going to give his thoughts on the upcoming Preakness and Nyquist's chances of winning the Triple Crown. And then we're also going to dive into the rapid-fire selections for the Black Eyed Susan, which is run on Friday at Pimlico, and the Greatest Stakes undercard Friday as well at Pimlico. Let's go. We are happy to welcome back John White to Blinkers Off. John is a Santa Anita odds maker, a longtime racing journalist, handicapper, analyst, and racing official. What's up, John? Thanks for coming on the show again.
Great to be with you guys again.
All right, so last time you were on the show, we previewed the Derby. We all three picked Nyquist to win the race, and he did, in fact, win quite impressively. So let's hear your thoughts. What did you think of the race?
Well, right off the bat, of course, we all picked the right horse, so that's good. It's never bad to pick if you pick the horse and the horse wins. So we were smiling about it. I mean, but, you know, one of the more interesting stats that I have seen concerning this year's Kentucky Derby, and this kind of blew me away, actually, Nyquist's $2 win payoff of $6.60 was the lowest win payoff at a 20-horse Kentucky Derby field since War Admiral paid $5.20 in 1937.
Wow.
That is really something. He was that big of a favorite in a 20-horse field. There hasn't been a heavier favorite since War Admiral. And, of course, War Admiral went on to win the Triple Crown. So I'm wondering if that's a harbinger of a Triple Crown for Nyquist. There were a couple of other things that I came away from the Kentucky Derby thinking. First of all, my feeling going into it was that the strength was in Southern California, and I think, again, that was affirmed by what happened in the Kentucky Derby, because not only did Nyquist win it, but Exaggerator finished second, and they were well clear of everyone else. So that, I think, is yet another example of that that's where the strength has been with this particular group. And I think that that is something to keep in mind going forward to the Preakness. So, you know, that's a couple of thoughts I had on the Kentucky Derby. And it, obviously the Southern California-based horses have been doing quite well in the Kentucky Derby, too, in recent years, you know, with I'll Have Another and California Chrome and American Pharoah sweeping the Triple Crown. And now we have Nyquist. So, and we've seen through the years how the Kentucky Derby winner so often has come back to win the Preakness. And so I think that bodes well for Nyquist. And, you know, it's really hard to envision to me Nyquist getting beat. However, that said, horse players, and in fact, any gambler will tell you that if a team or a horse or whatever looks invincible, that's about the time that they get beat. I mean, it makes me nervous when they look this good. And I've been down the road through the years with the likes of, I mean, Spectacular Bid in the Belmont Stakes. I mean, it was getting so boring in the Triple Crown at that time that people were actually talking that it was so easy that maybe they needed to change the Triple Crown to make it more tough. Because we had Secretariat, we had Seattle Slough, we had Affirmed, and it just looked like Spectacular Bid was going to do it. And right there, he got beat, and then we went on a 37-year drought. So, you know, that tells you right there that these races, even though Nyquist looks good, you know, he's got to go out there and do it. I'm more worried about the Belmont for him than the Preakness, to be honest, because of his breeding. But I'm a little nervous just because he looks so much of a slam dunk in this race. And, you know, you think of like Big Brown in the Belmont. I mean, here's a horse that was the only loss of his entire life, and he didn't just get beat. I mean, it was like, you know, a no-show that day. So I think of Reaver Ridge when he ran in the Preakness Stakes. You know, he was a 3-10 favorite, which that's between 1-5 and 3-5. And he had just won the Kentucky Derby by more than 3 lengths. He was like Nyquist in that he was the 2-year-old male champion. And I really thought he had a good chance to win the Triple Crown. And, in fact, I had written that in my high school newspaper as a junior in high school, which my high school newspaper got the best horse racing coverage, I think, of any high school paper in the country. And Reaver Ridge wins the Derby, and, you know, I thought he would go right into the Preakness and win that. So especially he went wire to wire in the Derby, and with that speed, you just figured at Pimlico, it was game over, but it rained. It was a sloppy track, and he didn't just not win. He ran fourth, and BBB wins the race. So, and then to show you how Reaver Ridge could have been a Triple Crown winner, he comes back and on dry land wins the Belmont by 7. So, I mean, he wins the Derby by more than 3, wins the Belmont by 7, but he can't finish first, second, or third in the Preakness on the sloppy track. And there is the prospect of a sloppy track here for the Preakness that we're talking here on Tuesday. And, you know, that's something of a concern from the standpoint that, you know, it makes you wonder if that will help Exaggerator. It probably will. Is it enough for Exaggerator to finally beat Nyquist? I doubt it, but it certainly makes it a possibility if we have a wet track, and it depends of what kind of a wet track we get, if we get a wet track. One thing that helps Nyquist is he won the Florida Derby on a wet track. It was rated as good. And also they had that rain about 90 minutes before the Kentucky Derby. That was certainly not a boned-up dry track by any stretch of the imagination, and Nyquist had no problem with that. So it looks like Nyquist is not a Reaver Ridge, at least, that Reaver Ridge really was one that just didn't really like a wet track. And so that it makes you feel better about Nyquist. And it's one thing I liked about American Feral last year was the fact that because I always have that Reaver Ridge in the back of my mind, I didn't worry about that with American Feral because of what had happened in Arkansas when he won the Rebel, you know, and he just looked so good on the wet track at Oaklawn. And so I, when it rained before the Preakness, a lot of horses I would have been worried with that. I actually thought it would probably help American Feral, and I think it might well have helped him. So that not rather than being a negative like Reaver Ridge, I think it was a positive for American Feral. But we don't. I think it would be a positive for Exaggerator. But is it enough of a positive for him to defeat Exaggerator when, you know, he's been unable to beat Exaggerator in four meetings between them? The score is 4-0 for Nyquist, and not only 4-0, but to me, it's certainly a sign that Nyquist has Exaggerator over a barrel when he's beaten him from 5 furlongs to a mile and a quarter. I mean, it's not very often that you see a horse have superiority over a horse at that range of distances from 5 furlongs to a mile and a quarter. So, and now we're backing up from the mile and a quarter, which to me plays into the hands of Nyquist. So, you know, and another thing that bodes well for Nyquist to me is the gallop out. Not only in the Kentucky Derby, because Exaggerator never got by him on the gallop out at all. I mean, Nyquist galloped out much better, I thought, past the finish in the Kentucky Derby. But going back to the San Vicente earlier this year, which was the race that I looked at after the Santa Anita Derby when I had contemplated moving Exaggerator to number one on my list, and I wanted to just review that San Vicente, and in that race, there was no question who galloped out better, and it was Nyquist, not Exaggerator. And that combined with the fact that Exaggerator had lost to Nyquist multiple times, I thought, well, there's no way I can put Exaggerator over Nyquist. And I think there's a very good chance of a scenario that we'll see the same 1-2 finish that we saw in the Kentucky Derby, and we also saw in the 7-furlong San Vicente. So I really think there's a pretty darn good chance that it'll just be the same exacta of Nyquist and Exaggerator. And I say that mainly because of the fact not only that these two horses were so well clear of everyone in the Kentucky Derby, but the so-called new shooters in the Preakness just have a dreadful record in the Preakness. You know, I mean, that's it doesn't seem to work for the horses that go into that Preakness that did not start in the Kentucky Derby. Only 3 of the last 32 Preakness winners did not start in the Kentucky Derby: Red Bullet, Bernardini, and Rachel Alexandra. And don't forget, one of those 3 won a Preakness in which the Kentucky Derby winner did not finish the race because he was injured, you know, in the early going. That's Barbaro. So there's the possibility Barbaro would have won that Kentucky Derby. I don't know, you know, to me it could have gone either way. But so that is an asterisk right there one of the 3 of the last 32 Preakness winners that did not start in the Kentucky Derby. So I always take a stand. I mean, it's like there's certain things in the Kentucky Derby. I always take a stand against a horse that did not run as a 2-year-old because the day will probably come where we'll have one. And a lot of people are going to say, oh, well, that's happened, so now we can just forget about it. And I look forward to that because just because it happened once doesn't mean we're going to suddenly see a rash of horses that didn't run at 2 win the Kentucky Derby. And you know, it'll take more than one for me to start embracing that. And, you know, it would take more horses to win the Preakness that didn't run in the Kentucky Derby for me to start looking at a new shooter, as they're called in the Preakness.
You know, I think it's interesting you're talking about those two horses finishing 1-2. It obviously would be a very chalky, a chalky finish. I read in your ExpressBet.com column this week that for the first time in Kentucky Derby history, the top 4 betting choices finished 1, 2, 3, 4 in order. How shocked were you that this happened? I mean, I know we kind of thought Nyquist was a standout, but we had made the comments and we had tried to pick some horses with some, you know, big prices underneath. How shocked were you that it came out like that?
Well, pretty shocked from the standpoint that, number one, it had never happened before. So anytime when we're talking about a race that's been run that many times and we see something that has never happened before, that is, you know, more or less shocking. But the other thing is that we really felt, you know, and I say we, in terms of most observers and most handicappers, most horse players, really felt that it was a pretty, you know, I'm not going to say necessarily wide open, but it was just kind of a, you know, it just seemed up in the air. I mean, the Derby, I was really prepared because if Nyquist didn't win, to me, it could have been anybody. Now, what's funny about that is, let's say something would have happened to Nyquist. Let's say he would have gotten beat. I mean, if it you would have to assume the chances are then Exaggerator would have won the race. So it wouldn't have been a wacky winner. You know, I just kind of felt that the way the race was shaping up, it could have been, you know, we could have been in store. And especially we just saw three straight Kentucky Derby winning favorites, you know, and I'm a guy kind of with a law of averages. I know what people say that if you flip coins and tails comes up 99 straight times, it's still 50-50 on that 100th flip. And, you know, I understand that that's probably true in the real math. But I'm going to tell you, if tails comes up 99 straight times, I'm betting heads on the 100th time that they're flipping the coin. Because you talk about do. I mean, that would be the ultimate do of all time. And that's just the way things actually work. I mean, law of averages, to me, does come into play. And, for instance, I mean, what are the odds that the favorite will win the Kentucky Derby next year for five in a row? Already, I have that in the back of my mind. I mean, to me, the chances of that are not necessarily too great, mainly because when we have 20, 19, 18 horses running in that race, that in and of itself reduces the chances that we can keep getting a horse to have a trouble-free trip to win as the favorite. So, and I've seen too many horses like Little Current in 1974 that should have won the Kentucky Derby, and that was the 23-horse field that was the record for the most starters in the history of the race. It was the 100th Kentucky Derby, and that's one reason there were so many horses in it. It was the year after Secretariat, and that was a wide-open Derby that year. There was just, it was a real just grab bag. And Little Current, it just had an absolutely brutal trip. And the way charts were called by the racing form in those days, before we had VCRs and the technology that we have today, and especially with Trackus and things like that, that chart kind of got all goofed up, and they were so busy trying to piece that chart together to have a chart for the 23 horses that they missed the trouble on Little Current. I mean, it's kind of a joke, really. And CBS did not miss the trouble, because in the Preakness telecast, they showed the trouble that Little Current had. And all you had to do was see that, and you just, anybody that has a clue goes, oh my gosh, that horse should have won the Kentucky Derby. Well, he won the Preakness by 7 lengths and the Belmont by 7 lengths. So, you know, that's a case of where, you know, a bad trip cost a horse very likely a triple crown. So, you know, as I say, in the Kentucky Derby, it's looking at Lucky. There's a horse that should have, you know, he might have been a Triple Crown winner. The only reason he didn't run in the Belmonts because he didn't have a chance for the Triple Crown, mm-hmm. and he got absolutely murdered from the one hole, but came back and won the Preakness, ended up being the three-year-old male champion that year. But if he's not mugged from the one hole and wins the Derby, he comes back and wins the Preakness and would have gone for the Triple Crown, and who's to say he wouldn't have gotten it necessarily? But these are the things that happen in races. What happened to Looking at Lucky? What happened to Little Current? And this is, like I say, this is what is something of a concern to me about Nyquist here in this Preakness, because people are almost to the point now they're acting like this is a foregone conclusion. But it's like, well, we got the Preakness, but, you know, we're going to be going for that Triple Crown at Belmont. The odds are that's true. But like I say, the more people just assume that this is a lock. I've seen these so-called locks. I mean, I saw Secretariat finish third in the Wood Memorial behind Englewhite and Sham, and people forget that Sham actually beat Secretariat once before the Triple Crown. I saw Secretariat get beat in the Whitney by Onion. I mean, you talk about a shock, because even though Secretariat had lost the Wood, once he went through the Triple Crown and then won the race at Arlington like a workout, it just looked like, I mean, no one could touch him. And the fact that a horse could go out there, in fact, a week before Secretariat got beat in the Whitney, 1 week before that, 7 days, he broke the track record for a mile in a workout at Saratoga. I mean, he just looked like, you know, he would never lose again for the rest of his life. And not only did he lose the Whitney, and he came back and got beat in the Woodward Stakes by Prouveout. So when you see that, you see Spectacular Big get beat in the Belmont, these are the things that cause you to realize that you just can't sit here and assume Nyquist is going to win. I mean, like I say, the odds are he will. But, I've seen too many of these so-called cinches get beat, and it just is, it's a concern to me that he's reached to this level now. I mean, I felt more comfortable about him in a way in the Kentucky Derby because he wasn't even odds on, but I didn't realize that even at the price he was at 2-1, and of course he was a shorter price in the race than American Pharoah and California Chrome had been in the Kentucky Derby. But I didn't realize that he was the lowest-priced Kentucky Derby winner since War Admiral in a 20-horse field. I mean, that is a real testament to him, you know, and it shows the public was not, the betting public was not buying into this, that they don't, he doesn't get respect business. You know, we kept hearing about how Nyquist, well, he doesn't get respect, and for all he's done, he doesn't get respect. Well, he got plenty of respect when he was pounded down to 2-1 and was the lowest priced Kentucky Derby winner since 1937 in a 20-horse field. That's a lot of respect. And you can bet he's going to get plenty of respect at Pimlico because he is going to be a short price there. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, you know, something that I keep going back to, and I think a lot of us do, because obviously American Pharoah is so fresh in the mind. We saw Triple Crown last year. Everyone assumes, oh, it's easy. It's going to happen again. I mean, how would you compare? Because it's kind of two different ways to look at it. Last year, we all loved American Pharoah going in. We, especially this group here, really loved American Pharoah going into the Derby. You know, he definitely, I would say, had his B effort that day. Still won, but everyone remembers, you know, Espinoza, how many times he whipped him down the stretch. Everyone was concerned about that. How good is he moving forward? You know, the Preakness, even though we loved him, the Preakness was seemed a little more wide open for Locke, because you also had Dortmund, you had Firing Line coming back. This year, it's like Nyquist for us was like, wasn't such a cinch. We still thought he was a winner, but maybe not, definitely not American Pharoah. And now all of a sudden it's, well, he's a cinch. He's going to win the Preakness. So it's kind of weird how we compare to American Pharoah last year and how all of a sudden Nyquist seems like, to a lot of people, has a better shot to win the Preakness than Pharoah did last year.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I think Nyquist has had going for him is I felt this all along, this is borne out by the buyer speed figures, you know, that group, the American Pharoah group, ran much better buyer speed figures than this particular group, including Nyquist and Exaggerator. And as I had written in my ExpressBet.com column, you know, I thought that could play into the hands of Nyquist because it showed that the bar wasn't set that high for him and that he might just be the best of this particular group. And I think that that's true. Again, I think the only one that's even in his realm at this point is Exaggerator. Now, we'll have Stradivari in here, but I mean, Stradivari, he's been impressive in two races, no question about it. But when I saw him work with Destin before the Kentucky Derby, I was not very impressed, to be honest. You don't want to judge a horse too harshly off one race, let alone one workout. But for a horse that I thought might be a real budding star, that work against Destin left me very cold. And I will say that I think it's a positive that Pletcher's showing up with him in the Preakness. People have made a big deal that Pletcher skips the Preakness. that he typically skips the Preakness with Derby horses because he's like most people, they don't want to run back in 2 weeks. So, I mean, this is a case where Stradivari was not in the Derby, so he's been pointed more for a race like the Preakness. He's been given time for the Preakness. I thought they would probably run Stradivari in the Peter Pan, and it would have been interesting if he would have been in there against the undefeated Unified. I don't know how that would have turned out. I mean, you know, Stradivari, maybe he would have won, maybe not. I mean, because Unified is a pretty darn nice colt in his own right, so... But Stradivari's got a really, I mean, I know he got 100 buyer in the race at Keeneland, and it was very impressive visually. I mean, but there was little behind him. You know, one thing to me you've always got to try to keep in mind in a situation like that is, okay, let's take Stradivari out of that allowance race at Keeneland, and let's put Nyquist in there. What would he have done? I mean, he would have won by whatever, you know, a mile too. Let's take Nyquist out and Stradivari out and put Exaggerator in there. I think he would have crushed that field too. So, in other words, you know, we got to kind of take that a little bit with a grain of salt. And it isn't that Stradivari's undefeated either. One thing I will say about Nyquist, and this goes into the respect discussion, but I've always had at least some respect for any horse or any team in sports that's undefeated because it's hard to win them all. And, you know, that is something that cannot be taken lightly here with Nyquist, that he's 8-for-8. You know, we went through this with, of course, Zenyatta, you know, and she went 19 before she finally got beat. And but it's hard. It's not easy because, you know, you can have an off day. You can have a bad trip. I mean, there's just so many ways. I mean, there's the old saying, there's 1,000 ways to lose a race and only one way to win. There's a lot of truth in that. And, you know, I was just discussing this with my wife earlier this evening, you know, about the fact that, people need to respect Nyquist. You know, Steve Beck mentioned this week on his radio show that a lot of people evidently in social media are saying that they're really hoping that Nyquist wins the Preakness because they're licking their chops to really bet against them heavily in the Belmont. Now, while I have felt all along that the Belmont would be the toughest one for Nyquist because of the mile and a half distance and the Triple Crown grind, which I don't care how fresh you are for it or whatever, these three races in 5 weeks, it's a mental and physical grind, and it can't be taken lightly. And so to me, I have felt that that's the race very possibly I will maybe take a stand against them, and I say maybe. But that said, I wouldn't be one of these guys licking my chops to go against him because if he wins the Preakness, that means he's 9-for-9, for Pete's sakes. It'll mean that he's won 6 grade one races on 6 different tracks, for Pete's sakes. So what I was discussing with my wife is there was a day that I was licking my chops coming into Santa Anita, and I was going to make a substantial wager against Zenyatta on a filly called Hysterical Lady, and it's because it was a 4-horse field in the Lady Secret Stakes prior to the Breeders' Cup. And my feeling was that Hysterical Lady, who was a very talented filly trained by Jerry Hollendorfer, she was the only speed in a 4-horse field. So this was a case where Zenyatta, with her running style, I felt was up against it. Not only that, but you have to also know a trainer's tendency. It's like a coach's tendency in basketball or football. And, of course, the training tendency of John Sheriff's is to have a horse at their absolute peak for the main event, which would be the Breeders' Cup, not the race before the Breeders' Cup. So my point is that Zenyatta, he had to be leaving something in the tank for the Breeders' Cup. And, you know, I was convinced, I had myself all talked in to be betting Hysterical Lady, but during the drive to the track that day, I sat there and had a discussion with myself, and at one point I said, what are you, nuts? You know, Zenyatta, I don't remember what she was at the time, but she was like 9-0 or 8-0 or 12-0, whatever it was. And I said, really, you're going to sit here and think this is some, like you've hit the lottery here or something to be able to bet against this racehorse who has yet to lose? And I thought, you know, that's idiotic. And I actually flipped it and decided, you know what, I'm going to bet Zenyatta. And I'm glad that I did, because it turned out I was far from alone with the thoughts that I had for the race, because it turned out there wasn't very much difference in the price between the two horses. In other words, Hysterical Lady got bet heavily, understandably, because she looked like the only speed in a race, and that she had a very good chance to steal the race. And she was like 6-5 or something like that, and Zenyatta was like 3-5, you know. It wasn't that. In other words, if I'm going to go against Zenyatta in that situation, I want at least, I mean, at least 4-1 and maybe 6-1 or 8-1 or so. I mean, I don't want 6-5 against someone of the stature and the ability, you know, and the record of Zenyatta. And this is what I'm just kind of throwing out there for those people that that are expressing the thought that they're thinking that it's an absolute golden opportunity to bet against Nyquist in the Belmont if he wins the Preakness. And they may, it may turn out that they're right, but I'm just saying I wouldn't be so cocky about it at this particular point, particularly since if Nyquist wins the Preakness as they want to take the stand against them in the Belmont, that'll mean he's 9-9, for crying out loud, and has won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes. You know, I mean, it's getting to the point where you just go, you know, like I say, I wouldn't be sitting there, you know, wanting to think that to bet the house against that horse in that particular situation, because he may very well seal the deal and win the Triple Crown at that point. I mean, I think he that's the one he could be the most vulnerable, but I say that with the absolute just tremendous respect for this colt, because he's earned it. I mean, he's so tough to beat, too, from the standpoint that, you know, and this is another thing I liked about American Pharoah, is he wasn't just a speed horse, or he wasn't like Zenyatta, a come-from-behind horse. You know, American Pharoah could win. He could go to the front and win, but he could also, you know, that was what was so important about that Arkansas Derby. That was the race that made me feel he'd win the Triple Crown, because when he sat beautifully just off the pace, that told me, you know, if somebody wants to go to the front in the Kentucky Derby, he can sit off the pace and win that race. And until that point, we did not know that with him, because he'd been so talented that he would just go to the front and win these races. And believe me, I've seen my share of front runners that if they don't get the lead, they put their tail between their legs and you can't find them. It's one thing I learned about dogs and dog racing, which I followed for a time when I lived in Phoenix, and I would go to the Phoenix Greyhound Park. You know, a dog would go out there at a low level, and if they got the lead, run a brave race, run a good time, and then they'd move up a level in class, say from C to B, and maybe win again. They go right to the front and get everything their own way, and then they go from B to A, and they'd get knocked around a little bit or whatever, and they'd get beat 20 lengths. You know, I mean, it's one thing you have to learn about the buyer speed figures or the Regazin sheets or the Thoragraph numbers. Horses will run bigger numbers when they get everything their own way. But a horse like Nyquist fools the figure players to the extent that he basically just does what he needs to do to win. And so that makes it tough on those figure guys, because they constantly underestimate him. That happened with my all-time favorite horse in the Pacific Northwest Turbulator. He just basically did what he needed to win. And but when he got when a push came to shove and he would have to set a track record or even on one occasion a world record, he had the ability to do it. But you know, he was underestimated very much early in his career, because he would just do what he did to beat who he was running against. And that's the case with Nyquist. You know, Nyquist's closest call, and it's something I'm going to address in my ExpressBet.com column this week, was his very first race at 5 furlongs. He drew the rail, and he wasn't even the favorite in that race. And, in fact, he went off at 7-1. And the heavy favorite in the race at 1-2 was a horse trained by Peter Miller, who had just lost his career debut by a nose. And so he had a race under his belt and Nyquist didn't, and he'd almost won. And that horse went off at 1-2 and battled with Nyquist right from the get-go. But Nyquist had a slight lead all the way into the stretch. And this other horse, Annie's Candy, headed Nyquist, and a mortal horse other than Nyquist would have lost that day. But Nyquist, once he got headed, said, "Oh, no, you don't," and he came back on and won the race. And that's really something you're not going to see very often from a two-year-old from the rail in their career debut. And here again, it's not like he got some big, you know, speed figure in that race. That's a case where, you know, he only got an 84. And so this is, but he did what he needed to do to win. And he only won by a head. But that's a case of where, you know, he showed such determination, such gameness, such heart. And that's something that we have seen. You know, Steve Beck has alluded to it, and others have said about in the morning, they've noticed, even sometimes when he's galloping, that he'll be competitive like that. And you'll see that with the real top horses. But the good thing about Nyquist compared to some horses, maybe even American Pharoah a little bit, you know, Nyquist, I think, is less gung-ho than American Pharoah. American Pharoah was a little more headstrong and made him a little more difficult to rate. You know, American Pharoah was more like Seattle Slough that way. Seattle Slough was really difficult because he was just a bundle of energy. He was like an equine tornado. And so he was hard for, that's why who rode him was very important. It was John Cruguet for the early part of his career and then Angel Cordero. But the rider was an extremely important element in the equation with Seattle Slough. And I think it has been too, with Nyquist, in that Gutierrez, you know, knows him so well and has such confidence in him. And one thing about Gutierrez, he's a guy that has shown, and he's proved this with I'll Have Another, that in the glare of the pressure cooker of a big race, you know, he can go out there and perform and not choke. And believe me, that's easier said than done. I've seen a number of riders and some real accomplished riders choke in Triple Crown races in my lifetime. So, you know, the fact that Gutierrez is proven so often that he's kind of oblivious to the pressure of that is a big plus.
You've kind of laid it out perfectly, the fact that, man, he can just do anything, and he has really all the checks have been checked off. You know, all the checklist of a really a great horse has been checked off. You know, I think you pretty much summed up the Preakness. Now, talking about
let me interrupt right there, because some of the things that he still would have to prove to be a great horse. Number one, he's got to beat older horses, and that's something American Pharoah was able to do in his final career start. Believe me, that's a very important aspect to American Pharoah. If he did not have that on his resume, it would really taint the view of him in terms of how he ranks all time. You know, not only did he win as a three-year-old against older horses in a major race like the Breeders' Cup Classic, but he, you know, won by daylight and, you know, just dominated the race. And at the time, there were some people poo-pooing the competition there, but that race actually had a pretty darn strong field when you get down to it. I mean, especially when you've seen what FNX has been able to do in horses like that. Tonalist would go on, you know, I mean, that was not a weak bunch in there, really, and he made them look weak. So that's something Nyquist still has to prove, and something he won't prove because he won't be given the chance to prove it, but that in my time, that would really prove a horse's greatness, they'd have to carry weight. Now, he is carrying 126 through the Triple Crown, which these days is a lot of weight, but right. Back in the day, you know, that was peanuts, you know, when we talk about the horses like the Forgos and the Kelsos and, you know, even again, my all-time favorite horse in the Northwest, Turbulator. I mean, that's a horse that I saw win a race under 134 pounds and get beat a neck with 138 pounds. So, you know, Man of War carried 138 pounds. And in fact, Man of War carried 130 pounds several times as a two-year-old. But weight, you know, for various reasons has gone out the window. It's a non-factor anymore. But when we talk about great horses, the real greats like Dr. Fager and so forth, I mean, those horses carried weight. And believe me, because horses aren't weighted much anymore, people don't understand its real significance. Because I will tell you, weight does matter, and especially in longer races. When we get to a mile and a quarter and we get to a mile and a half, you're carrying a lot of weight, and especially if you're spotting a lot of weight. You know, if horses are in that you're running against and they're carrying a feather, meaning like 108 pounds or what have you, you know, that's it's tough. And I've seen, you can see it visually on these horses that I've talked about. Once you get to 130 and over 130, I mean, you can see that horses sometimes are struggling with that weight package. And I've said many times for people that say, oh, it doesn't really mean anything, I say, well, forget about if you go to the airport with a piece of luggage. You know, nowadays we get to roll our luggage. Again, back in the day, we didn't have wheels on our luggage. We actually carried our luggage. And let me tell you, if you were carrying a suitcase that was, you know, packed to the gills and very heavy, and I'm running next to one of you two guys, and we're going to have a race to our car and or to the bus. Let's say we're going to, you know, have a race between the two of us to the bus, and I've got to carry the suitcase and you don't. Who do you think has the advantage? I mean, it's pretty clear.
Right.
So, you know, like I say, because of the fact that the whole situation, you know, weight has gone out the window. But when we talk about the all-time greats, that's something that should never, you know, be forgotten about the horses that did carry the weight. I mean, the great weight carriers, or as we say, the great weight lifters, the equine weight lifters. And I just marvel at some of those, of what they were able to accomplish. Like I say, especially Forgo, and especially when you realize Forgo's legs, what he was dealing with those legs. He was a big tank of a horse, and all that on those, you know, legs that were not the soundest legs to ever come along in the game by far. And don't forget, I mean, he was good enough as a three-year-old to finish fourth in Secretariat's Kentucky Derby. And again, when some people say, well, you know, Secretariat didn't beat much. Well, first of all, you start with he beat the sprint champion that year, Shecky Green, who was the Eclipse Award-winning sprint champion. He beat, you know, Sham, who would have been a Kentucky Derby winner in, you know, like 99 out of 100 Kentucky Derbies. He beat Forgo, who would be a three-time horse of the year, one of the, you know, all-time great geldings. But then later in the year, again, it was important, really important for Secretariat to win races like the first Marlboro Cup when he beat older horses and broke a world record for a mile and an eighth, beat his stablemate Reaver Ridge, beat Cougar II, Kennedy Road, horses like that, got his revenge on Onion, and then won races on the turf like the Man of War and the Canadian International. I mean, he beat a lot of really good older horses like Pentum on the turf. So, you know, again, that's important. And let's say if Nyquist won the Triple Crown and then for whatever reason, like Smarty Jones, retired after the Belmont, you know, there would always be that question of the fact that he never ran against older horses. And that is something that when we talk about trying to determine where a horse fits all time, that's something that that is a kind of a negative against them. I mean, Secretariat did not run beyond his three-year-old year, which is a real shame, because when you realize that horses don't really reach, you know, kind of full maturity till maybe when they're five, this is why, you know, we think of what maybe Secretariat could have done as a four-year-old, and we saw what Seattle Slough could do as a four-year-old. We saw what Affirmed could do as a four-year-old. We saw what Spectacular Bid could do as a four-year-old. Believe me, he was a win machine, so much so that he literally ran out of competition. And in his final race as a four-year-old, it was no race. It was a walkover. But even in the walkover, Shoemaker was on him. And they actually, you know, gave him a workout. And his workout, he ran fast enough. I mean, he went his last quarter real fast, and I mean, he posted a really good time in a race that it wasn't even a race. It was a one-horse race. And by the way, one thing about Spectacular Bid, for the people that don't really fully appreciate how great he was, Bill Shoemaker told me more than once, you know, because I would ask him, who's the best horse you ever rode? And I wasn't the only one. Lots of people asked him that. And believe me, the guy rode a who's who in this sport of horses. I mean, you look at the list of who he rode, and it's mind-boggling. And he never hesitated with me, never once. He said Spectacular Bid. And I once asked him, I said, why do you say him? You know, what made him the one that you say he was the best of all of them? And he said he had more gears than any horse I ever had. And believe me, he needed all those gears, Spectacular Bid, when he was ridden by a rider that was far from a top-level rider at Ron Franklin. I've said, in my opinion, and that's what racing's all about, opinions, but in my opinion, none of the all-time great horses, like if you take a look at the Blood Horses list of the top 100 horses of the 20th century, then put into that all the champions for this century, none of those horses ever had a rider to be on a regular basis as bad as Ron Franklin. So that was a real testament to Spectacular Bid's greatness. And, you know, what I said that once Shoemaker got him on him, he'd never lose, and he lost one time, and that was to a Triple Crown winner, Affirmed, when they met up. And Bid was the 3-year-old running against the older 4-year-old, which is something of a disadvantage a little bit. And Bid didn't break all that well at Dave. Shoemaker was not the greatest out of the gate. And one thing about running against Affirmed, if you gave him the edge right off the bat, you were in big trouble, because he was one of the all-time great horses. But not only that, he was a very game, you know, he had a lot of heart. But the thing about Affirmed was Seattle Slough showed that if you did blast out of the gate and take the race away from him, he was in trouble. And Slough showed that not only the first time they met, but then again in the rematch in the Jockey Club Gold Cup at a mile and a half. Even though Slough lost that race, he lost in a dramatic photo against Exceller, but that's what regarded as one of the all-time great losses in the history of the sport, and actually did a lot for Slough going to stud to show that he could be that game going a mile and a half. And that, of course, was also he'd shown he could win at a mile and a half in the Belmont Stakes to sweep the Triple Crown. But that's, you know, when we talk about Nyquist, and you know, he's checked a lot of boxes. That's true. I mean, already he has, and there's no doubt about it. But there are still boxes for him to check.
Okay, so we talk about the greats. Now let's talk about Nyquist. Will he become one of the greats? So will we go into Belmont with the Triple Crown on the line, and would you bet at this point that we will see another Triple Crown winner back-to-back years?
Right now, my gut feeling is no, but, you know, the part of it's going to hinge on what we see in the Preakness. You know, he could convince me, he could win me over still, but at this particular time, I would be tending to take a stand against him. If I were to bet right now, will he win the Triple Crown or not, I would bet against it, because there's just too many ways to lose the Triple Crown. I mean, it's too hard to do. And, you know, even though he's undefeated and even though he seems to kind of have this whole group over a barrel, you know, I've seen too many horses go to the Belmont Stakes that looked like, you know, they very well were going to win the Triple Crown. I did bet against Smarty Jones, but I didn't bet a horse against Smarty Jones. I bet everybody against him, because in Las Vegas, I bet on the yes or no, would there be a Triple Crown winner. I wasn't going to try to take one horse and try to beat Smarty Jones. And, you know, I did that against Fusaichi Pegasus after the Kentucky Derby. I just felt that, you know, people were kind of agog over him after the Derby, and I felt, you know, again, that it was a tall order for him to win the Triple Crown, and of course, he didn't even win the Preakness. So and then didn't even run in the Belmont. So, you know, I have made two bets on horses to win the Triple Crown. The first was I'll Have Another, and I bet that after the Kentucky Derby, and I got 7-1 on him. And so when he won the Preakness, I had 7-1 for the Belmont on a horse who was the 4-5 morning line favorite. That's what you dream of if you're a horse player, if you're a gambler. That's the situation that you, because they don't come along very much in your lifetime. I mean, they're far and few between where you're going to get 7-1 odds on a proposition, and he would have probably been a shorter favorite than 4-5, but let's say he's even 4-5. You're not going to get 7-1 odds on a 4-5 bet horse, that, you know, any, whether it's a team or a horse, whatever, in your life. And I had it and got all the way to the day before the Belmont. And that's why, you know, they build those hotels and so forth in Vegas, because even though, you know, I had a great bet, it doesn't matter because they won, I lost. So I had great, this is when people talk about value again. That's as good a value almost as you can get in racing, to have hold a ticket that you have 7-1 and, you know, he's going to be 4-5 or less. But the value doesn't matter if it doesn't win. So, yeah, it was a great bet, but not really, because it lost. Now, the only other Triple Crown bet I've made in my life for a horse to win the Triple Crown, as I say, I've made some on no for the Triple Crown, which is what I would do at this point with Nyquist, was American Pharoah. And I bet that before the Kentucky Derby. But one reason I was on the yes for both I'll Have Another and American Pharoah, I liked their breeding much more. I mean much, much more for the mile and a half than I do Nyquist. Now, you know, Nyquist has already proven he can win at a mile and a quarter. So, you know, I'm not going to say there's no way he can get a mile and a half, and especially against this group, you know. I would have my serious doubts about him beating American Pharoah at a mile and a half, and I'm not sure he could beat I'll Have Another at a mile and a half. I doubt he could beat Rags to Riches at a mile and a half, which means he probably couldn't beat Curlin at a mile and a half. See, and that's the thing that is the big issue in the Belmont. It's that distance. It just is. And particularly today, even more so than back in the day, because at least back in the 60s and so forth, horses had more stamina in their pedigrees than they do now. Mm-hmm. We're starting to get more stamina back into our pedigrees, but it's still not to the extent that you can look at a pedigree like Nyquist. I mean, you know, he's shaky at a mile and a half. It's just that simple. And, you know, how was he running at the end of the Derby? You know, he was running well. It wasn't like he was struggling, but and he galloped out well, which is what you'd want to see. That's good. But he's got to go another quarter of a mile in the Belmont. You know, not just another 16th. You know, one thing I taught our good friend Ryan, and I tried to teach people, like when I've been on the seminar at Santa Anita before the races, that type of thing, I've urged people to understand the poles at a track, what that means. And what I mean by the poles, I mean the 16th pole, the 8th pole, the 3/16th pole, the quarter pole. And you need to go to a track, look at those poles, learn what they are, but then also realize what it means. And I say that from the standpoint of that 8th pole, which is the furlong marker, or it's an eighth of a mile, 220 yards from the finish. That it's for all you people that read the racing form or any kind of past performances, Equibase past performances, Breastnet past, whatever the past performance is, because they come from Equibase. That call that is right before the finish, that is always at the 8th pole. That's called the stretch call. And that's even if it's a 2 mile race, a mile and a half race, or even a 4.5 furlong race. That is always the same. Now, the other ones change depending on the distance of the race. But that one is always in that same. That's how important that is. One of my key factors or categories in my strikes is the eighth pole factor. And once again, in this year's Kentucky Derby, where was the winner? As usual, first or second at the eighth pole. And in fact, he was, you know, in front and well in front. And that's important because, you know, you don't win the Kentucky Derby in the final 16th. You've got to be able to get into that first or second position at the eighth pole with 220 yards to run. But when you go to the track, look at these poles. And the first pole as you look up the stretch is going to be that 16th pole, which is the black and white pole, and it's skinny. It's the skinniest. Those poles that are in the 16th, they're always the skinniest. And then as you go up the stretch, the next one is the eighth pole, which is green and white. And that's that important stretch call. And take a look at when a horse is stretching out from 6 furlongs to 7 furlongs, that's how much further they have to run. They've got to run from that green and white pole all the way to the finish if they're stretching from 6 furlongs to 7. That's not a, like, nothing. That's a, believe me, it's pretty much like the length of the stretch. I mean, it's not that far. The length of the stretch on a typical mile track is basically from the 3/16 pole to the finish. Because once you go past the green and white pole, then you get another one of the black and white poles. That's the 3/16 pole. That's 3/16 of a mile from the finish. Then as you usually on a mile track, you'll go just as they're turning into the stretch. There's a big red and white pole, that's the quarter pole. That's a quarter of a mile from the finish. And that is going to be the distance, how much further Nyquist will have to run from that pole to the finish in the difference from the Kentucky Derby to the Belmont. And that's more than the length of the stretch, say, at Santa Anita, that he's got to go.
Right.
Oh. And I'm telling you, that is not like, well, you know, no big deal. Believe me, it's a big deal. And the proof of that is it's a big deal when the horse is stretched from the mile and an eighth of the preps, the final big preps, the Wood Memorial, Florida Derby, Bluegrass Stakes, Arkansas Derby, Santa Anita Derby, mile and an eighth races. They've got to go from the mile and an eighth to the mile and a quarter. So that's from that green and white pole to the finish. But now you're going to double that. And we've seen how critical that is, that stretch out from the mile and an eighth to the mile and a quarter in terms of horses in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, it separates the men from the boys, for sure. You know, that last eighth really gets to a lot of horses. Well, now when you get to that finish, you're going to have to go another quarter of a mile for the Belmont. And, I mean, that is, and to put it into some, you know, more perspective, most horses won't ever run a mile and a half again in their life. I mean, you know, again, when I was younger, that wasn't the case. A lot of the big races were a mile and a half, like the Jockey Glogoga. But, you know, we have the Belmont now. That's basically it. And these horses, that's the one time in their life they're going to have to go that far. That's why when I get a horse that I feel is just absolutely bred for it and has the talent, because you can't just have the pedigree, you got to have the talent too, but like Rags to Riches. I have never seen a thoroughbred that was better bred. I mean, she was born to win the Belmont. She had Belmont winners up and down that pedigree all over the place. I mean, her half-brother Jazzle had won the Belmont, and then, you know, right up on the top of the pedigree and the bottom of the pedigree. And when we get into the distance aspect of horses and how far they're going to go, for the most part, in my opinion, the bottom part of the pedigree actually means somewhat more than the top part. That's what carried Secretariat. Because he was my bold ruler, and believe me, there was people think that Uncle Mo was a question as far as siring a horse to win the mile and a quarter Kentucky Derby. It was said a million times that no bold ruler can win the Kentucky Derby at a mile and a quarter. Well, not only did Secretariat win it, he set a track record that still stands today. And, of course, he won the Belmont by 31 lengths and set a record that, believe me, nobody's going to touch. So, but where did he get that stamina? If he's got the bold ruler on top, where's he get it? He got it on the bottom, and he got it because he was out of a Prince Quillo mare. Sham was out of a Prince Quillo mare. That's another thing people forget. They don't realize that both Secretariat and Sham were out of Prince Quillo mares. That gave them both good doses of stamina on the bottom side to their pedigree. And by the way, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that Secretariat was a failure at stud. And, you know, I just cringe every time I ever hear somebody say that, because that is so far not the truth. He sired Lady Secret, who was one of the all-time great female thoroughbreds, a 1986 Horse of the Year. He sired General Assembly, who had to, he was in the same class as Spectacular Bid. So if it hadn't been for Spectacular Bid, General Assembly would have won the Kentucky Derby, finished second. And General Assembly won the Travers by 15 lengths and set a track record that still stands. You know, all these years later, since 1979, that son of Secretariat still holds the mile and a quarter track record at Saratoga. Risen Star had a brutal trip in the Kentucky Derby, then won the Preakness in Belmont, somewhat similar to Little Current. Very possibly could have been a Triple Crown winner himself. And if he'd been a Triple Crown winner, believe me, there wouldn't have been so much talk about Secretariat being a disappointment as a sire, because he would have sired a Triple Crown winner. But it wasn't Secretariat's fault that Risen Star had a brutal trip in the Kentucky Derby. But you know what's rather interesting is you will find Secretariat in the pedigrees of both American Pharoah and Nyquist. American Pharoah's dam and Nyquist's dam both are granddaughters of Stormcat. And Stormcat is a grandson of Secretariat. So if there had been no Secretariat at stud, we would have never had an American Pharoah or a Nyquist.
Wow. I don't know. That's the best way to end this interview right here. Because I think you just made it go full circle for every single person listening to this right now. Everyone's like, it's all at the same time. Like, oh man. So thanks, John, again for coming on the show. Best of luck in the Preakness. Obviously, I think we're all on the same page with going with Nyquist here, and hopefully we'll have you back on the show, and we'll talk about if he can win the Triple Crown.
Sounds great, guys. It'll be interesting to see how it all unfolds, that's for sure.
Right, no doubt. Thank you, John.
Time for Black Eyed Susan Day Rapid Fire Selections presented by Lanny. Lanny is our horse this week to present the Rapid Fire Selections.
Well, he is a ladies' man, so, and we're talking Black Eyed Susan.
I'll tell you what. This horse, I'm sold. This is my favorite horse right now. He just walks around like he didn't give two shits. There's all the pictures. There's a picture that surfaced today that I retweeted of Lanny at the Kentucky Derby. And he's just kind of walking around. You know, you remember he walked around on his own all before the race. And he just had that look like, I don't give a shit. You come near me, I'm going to bite your face off.
He did.
I love the horse.
Yeah, yeah. He's great.
And we're going to see him in the Preakness. But
I love it.
Friday, undercard. Race 7, the Pimlico Special. Handicap, it's a grade 3. We're 300K for 3-year-olds and up, going 1 3/16 miles. Field of 8, this is kind of the, we'd always talk about this comparison. Same distance, same type of race. We're going to see the Preakness, older horses this time. Led by Stanford, the 2-horse at 8-5. Going there.
Well, I usually love this race, but I hate it this year. It's pretty weak.
Yeah, it is real weak.
We did get the 1-2 finishers of the Charlestown Classic, so that's okay, I guess. Not much after that. Listen, Stanford, I went with him. I mean, if he shows up and runs his race, I just don't see any way he can lose. I mean, I think he's pretty strong. Now, I've heard that maybe he's going to scratch. We don't know yet. If he does, then I think Paige McKinney is pretty strong. So, Stanford, though, for me, if he runs.
Yeah, I'm with you, Stanford. It is weird to me that Pletcher's not totally committing yet to this, even though he's entered him, which is kind of a weird move to make anyways. So I'm not totally sure what's going on with him, but if he's in this race, you've got to respect him. I mean, he looks so good, at Charlestown there. And I really like both Pletcher runners. I Savvy Stomp. I mean, if that horse
at that price, it's not a bad price to take if Stanford is out of the race. You know, then anything could happen. You throw out two bad outings at Saratoga by Stanford, and this horse has never missed the Exacta. So he's a solid horse. He'll give it to you every time. Stanford from race 9, the Allaire DuPont, the Staff Stakes. It's a grade 3 worth $150K for fillies and mares, 3-year-olds and up, going to 1 1/8 miles. Field of 10 shows up for this one, led by Mei Ling. Very, very soft 3-1 favorite. The four horse, you go in that direction?
Well, you know, she should be the soft favorite, but at the same time, yeah, I did go that direction. And, you know, maybe I would like a little bit better price than 3-1, but, you know, the bottom line is she ran very competitive with Carumba, who I love. You know, I think Carumba is a very nice horse. And
ran well last time.
Yeah, absolutely proved last time, you know, that she didn't win, but she ran very well still. So, Mei Ling for me. I think she just might be a little bit classier.
Okay, this one, there's a value play for you, okay? I went with number 9, Super Majesty. It's a total gut play, okay? You look at it and you say, wow. You know, stretches out for the first time. Obviously, the breeding, you know, Super Saver, it should have no issues going long. Has a pedigree to do it. You know, the thing is, major class relief. Went from the Madison last time and the Breeders' Cup the time before that. Tough races. Now goes back to definitely a class relief. And, you know, when the horse did run at a mile, the only time it went longer than 7 furlongs, ran a really good second. So you could argue maybe the horse, you know, with Asmussen now, maybe the horse has something that, you know, when you stretch out, I have this feeling that maybe we see gate to wire here. Just, you know, Asmussen tells Giroudge to say go and see, you know, see how long, because we know this horse is fast.
Yeah.
So if she can get the distance, could be a total long shot coming in here at 15-1 morning line. You're gonna get it. So Super Majesty for me. Race 11, the Black Eye Susan Stakes. It's a grade 2. We're 250K for fillies, 3-year-olds going to 1 1/8 miles. This is like the Kentucky Oaks or the Kentucky Derby. This is for the Preakness. Field of 14. So we got a massive field show up for this one. And we got the two horses that that last ran in the Kentucky Oaks. Wheeling back here, Land Oversea finished second at your 2-1 morning line favorite. And Go Maggie Go, the up and coming Double Romance horse at 5-2. What do you think?
Well, it's got to be a two horse race, I think, between those two. And the thing I like about both of them coming out of the Kentucky Oaks, you know, wheeling back in 2 weeks, is, you know, Go Maggie Go is lightly raced and had a little bit of a, you know, not a layoff, but it had distance between the Gulfstream Park Oaks and then going into the Kentucky Oaks. And then same way with Land Oversea, she's not lightly raced, but she ran in the Fairground Oaks and then the Kentucky Oaks. So there's a little bit of a gap there. So I think they're going to come back and run well in the spot is what I'm trying to get at. I think there's enough factors that went against Go Maggie Go last time where she can turn the table on Land Oversea this time. I went with Go Maggie Go.
Yeah, she definitely, Go Maggie Go, for being her third lifetime start. Consider this, guys, her second lifetime start, she won the Gulfstream Park Oaks.
Yeah.
So then her third lifetime start, she goes into the Kentucky Oaks, the grade 1, and runs fourth, a very troubled fourth out of the gate. Had to go way wide. I mean, really was coming late. If you got to imagine if not had the trouble issues, she would at least been up there for... She would have hit the board easily. So, this is... To me, this is the horse. This is the now horse when it comes to this race. Land Oversea, I do like. I respect, clearly. But for a horse that's making, you know, the improvements each race, this is it. This is the horse. So, when it comes to value and price, when you compare the two, we obviously don't know what they're going to go off at. But, you know, you would think Land Oversea is going to go off as your favorite. So... I'm going to take more of a price here with Go Maggie Go, and I think she is the horse to watch now and moving forward out of this field. Race 13, the Adena Springs Miss Preakness Stakes. It's a grade 3 worth $150K for fillies, 3-year-olds. Going 6 furlongs, field of 10 in this one. Another wide-open race. I mean, you got 7-2 on Banry, the Wesley Ward horse there, but then you got, you know, Our Girl's a Charmer, 4-1. You got Moment is Right, 5-1. You got Lost Raven for Todd Pletcher at 5-1. It's really wide open.
You mentioned Todd Pletcher, and that's the one I'm going to go with, number 4, Lost Raven. Why? The distance. If you take out her races that weren't at 6 furlongs, or say one turn races that weren't at one turn, she's very, very good. She won a 5.5 furlong maiden. She won a 6-furlong stakes. She got second in a 6-furlong stakes, and then she won a 6-furlong stakes. Mm-hmm. So very good at that distance. I don't know. I just think in a race where there's not a lot of excitement as far as betting goes, this could be a nice price.
Okay, so I'm putting a lot of my money on Friday in Asmussen, and Asmussen bringing home prices. I went with number 7, One True Kiss. Finished full of run and last start at Oakland Park, where she beat 3, not 1, not 2, but 3 comeback winners, including DRC's Pretty Sky. Mm-hmm. You know that horse well.
Yep.
Came back to win the 65K stakes there at Prairie Meadows. Again, Prairie Meadows, but still, very nice
and
horse.
And ran well.
And that beat that horse very well.
Yep.
At Oakland. So here she comes back after a little bit of a break at Oakland. The pace, here's the thing, the pace is going to be hot in this race.
Mm-hmm.
So if she brings that same kind of run she did at Oakland, she has a good shot of winning this race. And at 15-1 morning line, I'll do it. I'll take a shot. One True Kiss. It's all time we have. Check us out at RacingDudes.com for our free picks and our premium selections on our handicapping products page. 100% money back guarantee and now covering all tracks. You can purchase our 1-month pro package anytime before or on May 21st, Preakness Day, and receive our full card Preakness tips and Belmont Stakes tips, plus the 10-page Preakness wagering guide we have available. We did the Kentucky Derby guide. That was a huge hit. It was really cool. This is a 10-page Preakness wagering guide. It's going to have the undercard races as well, some talk about that, the pace. So definitely worth you know, 1-month pro package, which is like $45. So right. You get all that together. Our full Preakness tips, if you just want Preakness, you can pre-purchase those now. Our pro tip sheet, if you buy our pro tip sheet for May 21st, you will be eligible for the 10-page Preakness Stakes wagering guide as well. So check that out. 31 tracks. We're covering 31 tracks now, all free picks. We're on Twitter at @race_dudes, LinkedIn, Google+, and Facebook. Stay tuned. We will have part 2, the Preakness Stakes preview, as well as the undercard rapid fire coming up later today. I'm Jared Welch, he's Aaron Halton.
RacingDudes.com for all of your leads. RacingDudes.com for all of your bets. RacingDudes.com, as good as it gets.